And good morning, a big welcome to This Racing Life. And we've stayed in-house this week because I wanted to find out a little bit more about Richo, the punter's pal, the value man. And he's popped in this morning on his way to, I don't know where he's going, but he's here. Morning to you, Richo.
Good to be with you, BM. This is actually my least favourable topic, and that is myself. Though we like to promote and...
Why the change?
That's right. Well, KB and I and you and I, we like to hang a fair bit of... stuff on each other, and that's all in good humour and amongst mates. But actually talking about my journey in racing feels a little uncomfortable because I know you've been speaking to some of the icons in racing, and I'm fairly new to the whole sport.
Well, that's okay, but you've got a reasonable handle on it, and I find even with youngsters like yourself, there's always a theme. Well, I went to the races with my mum or my dad or my grandma or something like that, and I was hooked just there.
Yeah.
Or I ran the SP at De La Salle College. We've all got those traces.
Gee, you've been doing your research.
This is Father Martin's confession time.
That's exactly right.
So let's find out a little bit more about how it began with you.
Well, I suppose you've touched on my grandma, and she was the one who really sparked my interest in racing. I was born in Hobart, but left when I was 4 months old. But my family was all in Tassie, so my mum was always taking us back 5 and 6 times a year. We would go back as young little kids to Hobart, where my grandmother and grandfather lived. And my grandmother is part of a significant family in Tasmanian racing, in the Best family, with her brother being Claude Best, who is a long-time trainer there and leading trainer, and in the Northern Tasmanian, I believe, Hall of Fame, that ridiculous scenario where they have Northern Tasmania and Southern Tasmania.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, the island's about 4 kilometres wide. For God's sake, people, get together. But anyway, I digress. So Claudie Best was that classic old-school trainer, and his sister, Nita, was my grandma. So every time we would go to Tassie, 5 or 6 times a year, we would go to the Saturday to Elwick. And I can never forget arriving there with my grandma. She'd go and see her brother, Claudie, and she would give him the book and say, and he'd just take it away, and he'd mark the book. And this book was like gold. And I, of course, you know, at 6 years of age, knew better than everyone. I'd be like, I'm on number 4. And she'd just be, no, I think that the 3 will beat the 7 and the 8. And, of course, 3 did beat 7 and 8 each and every race. And we would stand as little kids at about the 400-metre mark and race the horses on foot as they came down the straight at Elwick. And we could hear that sound of
the ground shaking.
The ground, yeah. Thunder of the hooves, the yah, yah with the jockeys.
Yeah.
Just fascinated me. We raced them as little kids, and, of course, they took straight off past us. And then when they'd come back in, you know, I'd be there, hi, Uncle Kelvin, hi, Uncle this, hi, Uncle that, because all our family were involved. We had stacks of them being jockeys, and one of my aunties married Gary Glover, who was a jockey.
G. Glover
at the time. The other auntie married Kelvin Ganderton. So Uncle Kelvin and Uncle Gary, as they were walking around, all that sort of stuff. So that's what I remember. And I remember just thinking, how good is this? And I always wanted to be a jockey.
Yes.
That's all I wanted to do. And, in fact, when I was in year 12, I was 4'11" and 51 kilos at the start of year 12. I was a really late developer.
Yeah.
So I'd actually started...
Year 12.
Year
that's
12
that's
at 16 years
16,
of age.
Yeah.
And I had the great honour of holding the sign in the front of the photos in every photo from prep through to year 12.
The little kid.
The little kid up the front. And I can remember saying in year 12, going to the careers advisor and saying, what do I have to do to become a jockey? And my mum said, for every Roy Higgins, there's thousands of them that are broke. You can't be a jockey. And I was adamant I was going to be a jockey. Just grew a foot and put on 40 kilos. That was my only worry.
Isn't it amazing how you can be just bitten by the bug?
Yeah.
And I know exactly what you're talking about as a child. And because my first taste of it was, I can remember Evening Peel winning the Melbourne Cup in 1956, and I was 6, so it shows you how old I am.
Yeah.
But I can still go back that far, remembering hearing the race, thinking, now, where's the caller? Where's the broadcaster coming out of the little Bakelite box? That I was intoxicated from that point on.
So straight away when you were looking at it, you were thinking of actually broadcasting as opposed to being on the track.
I wanted to be a jockey.
You wanted to be a jockey or a trainer. I knew nothing about being a trainer. I couldn't be a trainer. I wouldn't know how to
jockey
start.
For me. Yeah.
I'm still petrified of the horse. They're 600 kilos when I'm doing interviews after a race for TV, and if a horse gets near me, I'm like, hey, get out of the way. They're big, scary things. I couldn't even dream of doing it now, you know, as a 40-year-old with thinking about the danger of it. And that's why the admiration I've got for the little warriors of the turf who just sit there, and I talk about it time and time again. You and I do it when any time we're chatting to an audience, you know, 50 kilos, these men, starving, haven't eaten, dehydrated, yet are holding a little leather strap with their toes in the irons, steering a 500 to 600 kilo animal at 60 k's an hour and making split-second decisions.
It's a flight animal, a creature of flight.
Correct.
It's a herd animal.
Trying to get in and out of gaps, make that decision.
60 k an hour.
At 60 k an hour, and us punters sitting there in the grandstand going, oh, you got that wrong.
Yeah.
I mean, really, how dare we?
That's true. Yeah, we're all guilty of it.
Yeah, that's
right.
We're all
guilty of it. So that's where the bug sort of got you. But you had a little bit of an entree knowing the players in Tassie.
Yeah.
You know, and you're a little bit sort of in the inner sanctum.
Yeah.
So was Grandma, did she encourage you along the way, or where did she sit?
Well, she encouraged me at 11 years of age, and she's no longer with us, so she wouldn't mind me letting the secret out. She opened a TAB account for me. So I was 11, and I can remember every time we'd go over to Tassie, I would sit there with her on, you know, these memories, and you've probably got the identical memory of sitting there on a Saturday morning, though I was listening to you, Saturday morning with the form guide. And the form guide in those days was the newspaper.
Yeah.
You'd have the radio on, and in Victoria, I'd be listening to you or Bill Collins and Keith Hillier,
Craig and guys
all
like that,
about that, talking about the various horses. And I would have had my mind of, you know, set horses I loved, and then so-and-so would say something and someone, and I'd think there, and who sounded more confident out of those three? And I'd put a little asterisk there, and I would have one unit each way.
Is that right?
And if I really liked one, and I thought it was the favourite, because my dad said to me, listen, the one unit each way on Kingston Town's really not going to do it. But it was more about trying. It wasn't about the money, now that I think about it. It was
getting
more about
it, yeah.
It's actually, and that's one part of racing that I don't know if we sell well enough. It's actually trying to solve the riddle or the puzzle.
Yes. Yeah.
That I love that. And, you know, when you and I do tips on Racing Fix, or KB and I, even if I haven't backed it and I've given Kevin one at $10 at wins, I still get enjoyment out of the fact that
I
got it right.
Yeah.
Now,
yeah,
that stuff was really, you know, and my grandma would have her 2x2. She'd have two each way, and then she'd have a quinella and she'd have a trifecta. So her actually explaining, I'd be, well, what's a quinella? And she'd say, well, I'm backing them for the first and second.
And they can run either way.
And they can go either way. Oh, that sounds pretty good. And a trifecta. But what does a box trifecta mean? What does the rover mean in a box trifecta? All that stuff all came from my grandma.
And, you know, the whole equation of horse racing is weights and measures. And it's been like that since Lord So-and-so pitted his horse against the Baron of So-and-so's. Two horses having a race. The weights and measures have never changed for as long as we know. So what we're doing now has been done for, you know, from day dot.
Yeah, exactly right. And that
who goes the fastest from point A to point B?
But that's actually, it's interesting, because I come from a track and field background as well, where when someone runs heats and semi-finals of the Olympic 100 metres, we watch them run and then go straight to the clock and then dissect the times.
Yeah.
We don't do that as much in racing, because there's a lot of variables. And I don't know if we actually dissect them quite like we should. And I think that's going to be the new wave, is going to be so-and-so, oh, this horse ran 129.22 and the other horse ran last start 131.44, so therefore it's not going to be able to beat it. I'm not saying it's going to be as simple as that, but I think utilising times is going to be something that I think is going to really develop for the punter.
Now, back to your early days at school, I think it's normal, but you normally find the other kids who are interested in horse racing. I know when I went to Parade College, very quickly we found the kids who were the punters who wanted to do it, you know, wanted to get involved in the form guides. And actually, I was calling then. I was calling in grade five at parade because we had these ovals at the junior school at Alphington, you know, Fairfield Way. I'd have them running around the oval in the early 60s and I'd change their names to horses. So we'd have a race meeting at lunchtime and I'd do the call.
So I was the silly idiot out there running, getting
exactly. But you would have been trading under the name of Tullock. but there's always a group. You find the group that have got the same interest and you're normally punting through someone else, you know, because you're underage. Did you find that?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Well, we've got the common thread, and the common thread from a lot of our listeners will be, yeah, we went to a Catholic boys' school. And what do Catholics do? They love the races.
They're punters.
And I went to one in De La Salle in Malvern, right near Caulfield.
Oh,
and
perfect.
We had a lot of Caulfield boys at our school. And there was a really strong... There's a fair few of them that are involved in racing, and I probably won't name them because there's a few of them that have left the sport in disrepute. I won't go through some of their names. However, absolutely, you are 100% right. There was a group of guys that followed it, went in year 10, went to the races on a Saturday. Year 12, when I was doing year 12, they had our what we call SWAT vac, whereby you go away for 3 weeks and study before the exams, smack bang in the spring carnival.
What?
Well, it was a disgrace. I can tell you I got the quaddie on Oaks Day, but I didn't get a lot of opportunity to study for my exams. Now, I ended up doing okay. However, I thought that was just punishment for the Catholic boys. And it's also talking about, you know, taking on your story about calling. I can remember sitting as a really little kid, and I was doing little athletics. I was pretty good as a young athlete, but then because I didn't grow, I had a real dip where I didn't get to do a lot of athletics later on when you're 4'11" in year 12 and everyone else is 6 foot. You're taking a lot of steps, my friend. I can remember watching Kingston Town win a Cox Plate where he sat behind the leader and... Bill Collins, he went around one horse, and Bill Collins said, we're going to see the real one today.
Yeah, he went around Yurtis, whatever it was,
and just
Pete
bolted
Cor,
him.
Whoever it was. Might have been R. Quinton, but just, it was all over.
Bolted in. Well, I ran the 800 metres the following week at Little Aths, and I...
You were Kingston Town?
...sat second rather than leading. You know, little kids, you just take off normally.
Yeah.
I sat second behind. And I can never forget thinking of Kingston Town and got to about 100 metres out and saying, we'll see the real one today.
You've got to see the real Richo today. Bang.
Peeling out and running down. Yeah. Like, what an imbecile.
Yeah. But that's how it all sort of all started. Yeah.
Yeah, so that was, through my family, and then they've developed a lot in racing and that Tasmanian connection through my other uncle, Johnny Best, who was Claude's brother. He owned a horse called Sunny Lane, who ran in a Melbourne Cup, and it was a great thrill for us. He won a Werribee Cup, or she did. She won a Werribee Cup.
Didn't she go to Hong Kong?
Third in a Hong Kong Vase, back before it
That's
was probably
right.
at the
Hong Kong Mile, one of those.
Super elite race. Yep. She ran in a Melbourne Cup. I think she finished more towards the rear. He owned a lot of horses with the name Private over in Tassie, Private Property, Private Talk, private, the whole lot of them.
Yeah.
He was a star full forward for Glenorchy and ended up being the president there. And he was a publican. So going to Hobart, I had my grandma there who introduced me. Her one brother was the leading trainer. The other brother was the star full forward publican who owned a whole lot of horses. You had to be bitten by the bug then.
Yeah, and you spoke about Claude Best and his training, and he was associated with Runnymede Stud,
Sir Donald Trescothick. Yeah. In fact, my one of my second or third cousins, Mark Ganderton, has been given the permission by the Trescothicks to use those colours. He had a runner last night at Launceston. Catwin Boyer wore those colours, the colours that were carried by Mr. Jazz when Mr. Jazz ran third in a Melbourne Cup.
Kiwis Melbourne Cup?
I think it was.
Yeah,
I think it was. KMRA and Mr. Jazz sort of were fighting it out. And then
Kiwi came from the clouds.
That's right. Those blue, white and orange colours.
Sir Donald's colours.
Mark Ganderton, from his grandfather, Claudie, still has the colours as a trainer.
Great connection here. We're going to take a break. This Racing Life, our special guest is Richo, Jason Richardson.
At the 400, and it's our Paddy Boy, Prince Ruling, and Yurt is, but Kingston Town's cantering. We're going to see the real one today. Then three lengths wide, Tangaroo are running on well from Family of Man. On the turn, and Kingston Town cruised up to our Paddy Boy, took the lead. In the centre, Prince Ruling, and then Yurt is and White Tangaroo. But the real Kingston Town's going to street them, and Kingston Town's gone on to win by four lengths.
Yes, well, there's a great call by Bill Collins. Going to see the real Kingston Town today.
And that's the impact that the race caller has that you had when the earth begins to rumble with might and power. You're probably not thinking it when you're just doing your job, that there's little kids out there that might be just hearing something. And how stupid here in my 40s that I can remember that we're going to see the real one today. Because Kingston Town was a Sydney superstar who hadn't translated his form to Melbourne. I remember that as a little kid, everyone talking about that and, listening to the
radio.
Gets
on his wrong leg.
Got on the wrong leg, couldn't handle Caulfield. I can't even remember what races he ran in. It was too young. But for that to have that impact on me and the style of just running up behind them and translating that into little ass as a little tidy kid is just hilarious.
Well, when you reflect back on, he couldn't handle the Melbourne way of going. He won three clocks plates. It's never been equal. Never. No. Probably never will. He got run down in the dying stages of the 82 Melbourne Cup, and the jockey went too early, Malcolm Johnson.
With 59
or 50, yeah, something like that. And Gurner's Lane got up on the inside and grabbed him right on the wire.
It was a serious stayer.
So I don't know about wrong leg. Yeah, I'd like to see him on the good legs. Just back, the Tasmanian connection's interesting. The Claude Best, through your grandma and her brother, Claude Best. He really was an icon of racing over there. When you look at those Runnymede stars, horses. I remember the blue and white hoops, the Cardinal Courage, the Cardinal Court.
That's right.
Monarchist, a very good mare called Beau Mistress, which eventually came to the mainland, was trained by the Elkingtons.
Yeah, and wasn't she? She was like a wet track specialist.
She
went
at Liston Stakes or an Oar or something like that. She was always advanced.
Start of the spring, a wet tracker. I can remember as a young kid this is once again how silly names pop in your head. Her battles with King Delamere.
That's right.
And just hearing, and the fact she was a Tasmanian, and we had a connection there. It's great that they have a race named after her, the Beau Mistress. But Claudie, and then that transferred on to his kids and his grandkids. So out of that family tree came the Marie, who married Leon Wells, who's still one of the leading trainers in Tasmania, and their sons, well, Dean's now co-trainer with Leon. One of the other sons, Trent Wells, came here and was a really successful jumps jockey and rode, I think he won a Hiskin steeple here at the Valley, I think he won a significant race from memory. And then the other side of that, still coming down from that Claudie family, one of his other daughters produced Brendan Larkins, who we used to go and watch as young kids riding a couple of Michael Trinder's jumpers called Tengahari and Monsist were two that come to mind.
I remember those two horses. 85 Monsist won the Hiskins at Moonee Valley. The following year, Tengahari won the Hiskins in 86. Tengahari ran second in the National in 87 at Flemington, third in the 85 National.
Right.
Third in Australian steeple, second in Australian steeple. And those Tasmanian jumpers, they not the ones you wear, but those steeplechases, they were terrific.
They were tough, weren't they?
When jumping racing was really at its zenith through the 70s and 80s.
Yeah.
And you had the influx of jumping horses coming out of New Zealand. You had Jim Houlihan in his prime.
Yeah.
You know, it was big deal racing and you had to be good. And Tassie was always well respected with their jumping horses.
I think Brendan married someone who you would know a lot about, who was an absolute phenomenon in Tasmania, and Bev Buckingham.
Oh, yes.
Can you remember how successful she was as a jockey? I've never met her because I'm talking about my second and third cousins here, but as Tasmanians, we're all cousins. Second and third cousins, so it's a long way away, but I see the connection where I catch up with them, unlike my brother and sister, who haven't seen them for 30 years, is through racing. Because when I'm working there at racing, they're often Leon will bring a horse over from Tassie, or Trent Wells was riding, and Dean Wells was bringing a horse over as well, and the Larkins boys, Will Shane, thinks now the chief steward in Victoria for harness racing, etc. Yeah. So that connection is still always there through racing. But Oh, it was, yeah, interesting times, isn't it? Looking back on some of those Tasmanian horses, they, you know, they still do a solid job. We've seen that obviously highlighted by the cleaner, but probably not to the levels they once had.
When you left school, you went into the workforce. Where did you go?
Well, I it was interesting because I always wanted to. I had just a great ambition in life. I wanted to be a sportsman first and foremost, and if I couldn't be, then I wanted to be a media person talking about sport. I was just obsessed by sport. I was one of those kids who was absolutely obsessed by sport. After, you know, whole weekends were just spent playing footy, playing cricket, trying to convince my brother to come and play cricket, younger brother. He was not that interested in the sport. And I'd be like, come on, please, you know, you bat. You can bat four times before I ever bat. So I'd, you know, bowl to him gently, just keep him interested, and then eventually rip a couple through him and knock him over. And then he'd say, I don't want to play anymore, so I wouldn't get to bat in the backyard. And we'd have kick-to-kick footy, and he'd lose interest, and I was just kicking it to myself. So out of school, all I wanted to do was be involved in sport. However, when I was really small and it didn't, you know, like I had a, you know, solid junior footy career, but I wanted to be an AFL footballer, but it didn't look like that was going to come about. And I actually went and started to train to be an accountant. I went to RMIT accounting.
Dear.
As don't I look like an accountant?
No. You haven't got a cardigan.
No. So I started working in accounting, and then with always wanting to be involved in sport, and actually a fantastic bloke by the name of Keith Merton, who was the assistant chef de mission for a couple of Olympic Games and was involved in five Olympic Games. He was the chief executive of Australian hockey. And I had a meeting with him through a friend saying, I really want to get involved in sports administration on the side, sports media, or actually being actually an athlete out there was something that I wanted to do as well. But and he gave me a job in sports administration with the Australian hockey team, which was fascinating. Great. Absolutely loved it, combining a bit of my business with sport. And that set me off on a sort of a business marketing sport sort of background. And then on the side was the actual stuff out on the field.
Well, you won the store gift in 93, and we'll replay that magic moment for you in a moment. And you won the Bill Howard, which is sort of one of the top sprinting races up there in 92, the year before. So when did you get serious about athletics and professional athletics?
Well, I was really serious about my aths as a really young kid, but once again, reflecting on how small I was, I went from being probably one of the best sprinters at 11 and 12, roughly one of the best sprinters in the state, versus couldn't make my relay team at school in year 12 because I was just so small. So that really knocked the confidence in regards to sport. And then I grew outside once I finished year 12, started playing and was playing footy at De La Salle Old Boys in the amateurs. We were undefeated under 19, had a really elite team. That kept me really involved. And then I just, you know, started to grow and thicken. And it was interesting. I was coached by a guy by the name of Brian Brown and his brother, Chris Brown. And this is, once again, just comes down to people you know and people you bump into in life. Chris Brown, a fantastic bloke, like his brother Brian. Chris ran third in the 1976 store gift. Said to me, gee, I reckon you can run a bit. You should do a bit of running. And this sort of just bubbled along on the side. Yeah, you should do a bit of running, And, of course, I'd thrown the spikes in the bin when I couldn't make a relay team in year 12. And some 3 years later, after playing footy and growing a bit, I took him up on his offer, said, okay, pre-season, I'll come down. I think it was because I realised I wasn't going to make it in
footy. Is this sort of about late 80s?
Yeah. Now, this is it's early 90s. So, I won the store gift in 93 and won the Bill Howard 92, and that was my first year of running. So I was, I got in early 92 and started training and trained for a couple of months and won the Bill Howard. And Chris said, mate, you should take this a bit seriously.
So it's all about the store gift, and I called it a couple. I called the centenary store gift that Warren Edmondson won.
Yeah,
I called
1977. Off 1 3/4.
Yeah, and I called 77, 78, and 79, and then Pete Donegan took over.
Right.
because I was called back for that weekend to be calling horse racing or trots or something
like that.
And Pete
will be calling the store gift this year with myself on Channel 7.
Fantastic.
Which will be great.
That's fantastic news. And it really has evolved. It could have gone one way or the other when I reflect and look back so far back. But I didn't realise what a big deal it was. And I only got the call up on the Sunday before the gift on the Monday.
Right, okay.
So Johnny Russell used to cover it for 3 years, and Bert Bryant got terribly sick at that Easter weekend. John had to take over calling at Caulfield, and I got the call up on the Sunday to do the store gift the next day.
It is such a unique event. If you
very much a race call. It was a real racing this time.
Well, you would have been fantastic at it.
I could keep up.
That's what it was about. And
big deal, though. Massive deal.
You know, 20,000 people are there at Stawell. And the unique thing about Stawell is you get one chance. As an athlete, you get one opportunity because it's a handicap race. So therefore, the handicapper is assessing how fast he believes you can cover the 120 metres uphill at Stawell.
Yeah.
So if you show him, and he handicaps it for 12.20. If you show him that you can run a bit faster than that, your handicap in the future will be adjusted accordingly. I knew through the training group that I had, which was Tim Mason, who had been second in the store gift previous years, Joe Marvin, who had been second the year before. These guys I was training with, giving them head starts and beating them. Yet in the store gift, I had the novice mark, the new kid mark of 7.5. I knew that I'd go close to running under 12 seconds. So I had one chance. Because as soon as you showed how you could run, the following year you were going to be handicapped accordingly. And that's the unique thing about Stawell. You get one opportunity. I still just get sick in the stomach just thinking about how nervous you are beforehand, how you're struggling to get any saliva in your mouth. That time where they say, onto your marks, and that whole crowd hushes is something that gives me goosebumps just thinking about it.
Let's go back to 1992. This is the Stawell gift. Dean Capobianco.
93.
You won the Bill Howard 92. So this is 93. Capobianco, famous runner, is on scratch. So he gives you 7.5 metres.
He gives me 7.5. And he won the Stawell gift in 1990 off 2.25. And he ended up, he was great mates. You know, he and I became great mates. And I trained with him a fair bit leading into 93 because I spent some time over in Perth. Because, you know, my coach said, listen, you're going too well here. You can't race in Victoria. Just go and just keep training. Disappear, if you like. So, once again, kept protecting the handicap that I had. And I went and trained a lot with Cap. And he was a guy who was in the Olympic Games in 1992. Here is I training with him. He was better than I was, but only better by one or, you know, by 2 or 3 metres. Not by 7.5. Yeah. He knew. He's going into the gift final just shaking my hand before him going, mate, welcome to the club, brother. It's going to be great. It's going to be great. Just get the job done.
God, that must have been amazing.
Yeah.
It must have been amazing. And they talk about the betting plunges, but if those in the know knew that, you know, you had your right mark in 93, tell me that on Friday night or on Saturday night you were 50s into 7-4. Just tell me that.
I think I was 16s or 20s. I mean, at Sportsman's Nights, I try to add a bit of mayonnaise to it. 16s or 20s was the best price available on the Friday night. And I think I started my heat of the store gift at about 3-1 on.
Yeah.
So we got a little bit of money on, but probably not as much because then a guy by the name of Mark McDowell, God love him, who had waited. Here's me. Basically, had been training for 8 months. 14 months, having my first proper crack at a store gift. This bloke had been waiting 11 years.
Oh, no.
He'd got out to 9.5. He'd been patient. He'd been running 400 metres, never running the 120 so he could be reassessed. Year after year after year, the mark got out and out and out. He's got 9.5. They've put the money down. This is the year. And then some little upstart flog like me comes out in my first serious year and gives him a couple of metres and beats him. And now, Mark, every time I see him, he goes, oh, that's the bastard that cost me a house.
We're going for a break. Yellow rug?
Yeah.
In the yellow rug?
In the yellow silk. We like to call it the silk, but you can give it a rug.
Okay, let's go to the break with the Stawell gift of 1993. And Richard.
And away they go. Capobianco away well. Cool quickly in the stride with Fuba. Richardson, then coming Martin McDowell. He's a great go. The yellow's in front. It's Richardson homing away. Coming at him again, McDowell. Richardson in front. Richardson beat McDowell. And third aim then would have been Josh Cool. Then Dean Capobianco, who couldn't do it from Tony Martin.
Well, Jason Richardson has won the store gift in emphatic fashion.
You must be very pleased.
Oh, it's the ultimate.
You've done
it. Just can't believe it.
Thank you for the gift.
Dreamed about it for about a year. Wanting to emulate John Dine and win the Bill Howard 1 year and gift the next. I just can't believe it.
We went to the break with the win there and the comments from you, the ultimate.
Gee, as an SEN, give me a fair old feed up flogging. About absolute flogging. You'll find all athletes are very insecure about their lot in life. And as soon as I won the Bill Howard, I wanted to win the store gift. As soon as I won the store gift, I wanted to win the backmarkers and represent Australia. And as soon as you go to overseas and run against, you know, I was privileged enough to run against Carl Lewis and Michael Johnson, Linford Christie, and they all have one thing in common. I saw their backsides the entire way down the 100 metres or the 200, or in
that
Michael Johnson's case, 400 metres. And that's where you see where you're really at. I mean, though it is, you know, I'm really proud that I was, my name's on the honour board at the store gift. You get a fair slap of reality when you actually get amongst the real boys, and that is seriously elite.
Yeah, but you've got to have a crack at that. If you're in that sort of league, you've got to go and have, you know, throw out the stumps. But you're still a part of history, and they can't take that away from you, from that famous honour roll, which is 140 years old. There you are, up on that brown board.
Yeah, and I think the following year I was able to win the...
And you're in the Miller's Guide.
That's right, the Miller's Guide. I was able to win the Backmarkers 120 the following year, and that gave me so much satisfaction because that's of all the boys that are, you know, that's basically all the best runners. They get to run off tight handicaps and see who's probably, you know, the fastest at the carnival at the time. So that gave me a lot of satisfaction. I should have stopped there at stall for 3 for 3 because it's damn hard to win a race up there. And to win the big one's awesome, but to win any race there during the stall carnival, because it's the grand final for everyone involved in athletics there. So I should have stopped there. I had a couple of other attempts at it. But then I really concentrated on running amateur athletes. And I used the prize money I won for stall. I quit my job. And Keith Merton was really understanding because I was working with him in a sports management company. I went back to uni part-time so I could... But I really concentrated being on a full-time athlete. And I lived for 5 years as a full-time athlete. I was partnered up with, as in from an athletic point of view, as the training partner with the great Catherine Freeman. So there was three or four of guys who were, you know, solid sort of Aussie level 200, 400 metre runners. I was the worst of those. And she needed to train with blokes because she couldn't train with girls. She just... far too good. So she would just be chasing us behind. You know, we went over to El Paso, Texas, and lived there for 4 months. And with her just getting whipped all the time, but just chasing. That was leading up to her world championships in 1997 when she won the 400 metres from lane one. She was just brilliant. I mean, what an athlete. And you learnt so much about her. I mean, she keeps things really simple. Just run one lap as fast as you can. But we would say, she would look at the training schedule and it'd be like 2 laps warmer. She would start on the line and finish on the line. There'd be no calling, you know, stopping 10 metres beforehand. And every rep was done at her absolute maximum. And we had this session where we had to do 6 200 metres. We had to go flat out for 200, walk back across the track. We had a 5 minute recovery, go again. We had a 4 minute recovery, go again. 3 minute recovery. And lactic acid tolerance was my weak point. We got to the last where we had a minute recovery and we took off and the legs are full of lactic and there was bloody Freeman coming up on the outside. I thought, she can't beat me. I'm struggling. I can never, ever forget. It was at El Paso, Texas, on the track there that's run. Obadali Thompson ran the fastest 100 metres ever there. It was wind assisted. And there was Freeman coming up on the outside and we were battling it out, obviously going at a really slow pace because we had so much lactic acid. You know, we're normally doing 200 metres in 21 seconds. This was 25. She bloody beat me. She let me know all about it. She let me know all about it.
How did you feel when she won gold in Sydney at the Olympics?
I was there that night. I'll never, ever forget it. You know what? For her, I was just so pumped for her because she'd gone through a lot of turmoil in her life, and it's something that I don't know if Australians really... maybe know the background or, you know, forget. But everyone talks about the pressure of carrying the, you know, doing the torch and being the icon for the Aboriginal movement.
Yeah.
She had huge turmoil in her life. Her partner, Nick Bedeau, who they'd been since Kath was 18 years of age, they had a really tough breakup, yet he was still managing her and sort of coaching her. So that was tough to be able to keep that relationship. She had a new man in her life, you know, the tension between your former partner and your current partner. She's trying to balance that, being the icon, balancing sponsors, balancing a family that has comes from a really underprivileged background that has this icon that's having, you know, money thrown at her. And she was able to handle all of that and still run extraordinarily fast and win. You know, I was just pumped for her. It was a moment that none of us will ever forget.
Yeah, yeah. No one in Australia will ever forget that. But being close to her through your training regime, and that must just have been unbelievable.
Yeah, and probably understanding that backstory and knowing how much pressure she'd been under. She's a tough woman. I mean, a brilliant athlete, but a tough woman too.
That's your athletic world, and it's a great story. But what about horse racing? We see you at TVN, which is now gone, and we've spoken a lot about it. Mm. There's a new wave now with Racing Live, which is available through, you know, internet and on iPad and different apps and things like that. What does the future hold now for you? Because at one stage we thought, where's Richo going to go? You know, without pumping up your tyres, I will. You're good at it. You're good at it. People like you. People gravitate to you. You've got this happy persona, and people are comfortable with you. Not all of us, but you do, and you do it well. You do your form. You know what you're doing, and you're a bright, fresh face with the best set of teeth, I think, in the racing industry.
All natural.
Outside
too.
Mr. Ed.
Yeah.
You know, all natural. Which
no
is
braces.
Even better. No braces. So, you know, this, but you're a refreshing change to a lot of, to a sport that, you know, has got a few old faces in it. You're looking at one now. But you're good at it, okay? So we were worried that you were going to get left behind, but you haven't been left behind. And you didn't really know till the death knot.
No, it was, you know, TVN folding. I mean, firstly, it's something that I absolutely love doing. I started in media in 2000 at the Sydney Olympics when Channel 10 out of the blue gave me an opportunity to do interviews with a whole lot of athletes when I was working as marketing manager with Oakley Sunglasses. And I had access to a lot of athletes there. So I've been doing, you know, been involved in television since 2000 and through SEN involved in media. We absolutely love it. And morphed into racing through our good mate, Dr. Turf, who was given the contract to do Friday night racing, which was a beast that no one at TVN wanted to do. No one wanted to do the TVN Friday night shift. So they outsourced it to Doc's company, Croc Media, and he asked me to come along and be involved. And that's how we started to work together. I loved my association with TVN. They were terrific to me, and also Channel 7. I've done a bit of work with 9, doing work with 7, and we're doing more work with 7 through the championships, which is fantastic opportunity, and doing the store gift, and like to do more and more with them if they'll have me and if that's possible. Gee, it was, you know, TVN announced that they were going to fold, and everyone in the industry, it wasn't until the last couple of weeks that people went, oh, actually, now that we think about it, we're not so happy about that. So the overwhelming reaction was wonderful for us in front of the camera. But you know, you've worked there. The guys behind the camera are working their butts off.
Yeah.
Eventually, Victoria Racing has decided, you know what? We believe that our product needs to be available to everyone, not just to our key wagering partner being Tabcorp/Sky. We believe it should be available freely to everyone, and we would like to provide a service whereby Tabcorp customers can get it, Sportsbet customers can get it, Sportingbet, blah blah, everyone can gain it. Now that's what the road that they're going down. Philosophically, I 100% agree with what they're doing.
Sure,
they've started the company called Racing Live, which at the moment is on the internet for the next couple of weeks until it finds a television home, but it needs to find a television home.
Will it?
It will find a television home.
Soon?
Yeah, absolutely. I have no doubt that will happen.
Number 5?
Well, will it be 522? Will it be the Seven Network? There's a lot of legal issues and a minefield that they've got to tread through.
Because that's what the punter wants. The punter wants that back because you take something away. Now, we had troubles with TVN, some of the presentations. We thought we could have got a lot better.
Correct.
But we do miss it. We do miss it because it was a great service for the racing industry in the state.
Sky will do a terrific job with Sydney Racing.
But we won't get the attention the TVN gave racing in this town.
And that's not a criticism of Sky. That is purely because Sky has a responsibility to one entity, and that is their shareholders.
Sure.
So their shareholders are wanting dividends. Dividends is coming from Tabcorp and Sky, and they don't want Sky to be, you know, Sky's got a responsibility for turnover. Mm. And I totally understand that model. And it's not a criticism of them. That's their business model. Now, they will showcase Sydney Racing. If Victoria jumps into bed there, which there's some to say that will still happen, that could be a good marriage. However, will Victoria Racing get the spotlight? We had to tell the stories, showcase the personalities, the participants in a way that can best service the industry. I don't know the answer to that. And at the moment, Victorian Racing says no, because they're willing to go it alone.
Yeah.
Will they eventually buckle and go with Sky, or will they go it alone and put it on a Foxtel channel and allow Sky, like they're doing at the moment, to jump into their coverage for their mounting yard coverage leading into a race? Yep. But then in between, showcase the stories, the personalities, the participants
of the
sport.
Which we had for 10 years.
Correct.
Yeah, exactly right. Yeah, that's a fair summary of it all, but that comes at a cost.
Correct.
Yeah.
It comes at a cost. It needs to be subsidised by someone. And whether or not you can gain enough money...
Is it the corporates who will pay for it?
Well, can you get enough money from a combination of TAB plus all the corporates? Or are you better just putting it all in the hands of your number one wagering provider, which is tab.com.au? That's the decision at the real top end of Victorian Racing. They've got to make that call.
Okay, so things are okay for you now, but do you find that it's
short-term
sort of,
for the next 2 weeks?
Yeah. Well, that's a little bit unsettling, isn't it? You've got three little girls, and you've got kids going to school, and you've got a mortgage, like most.
And okay. I'd love to stay in racing. I love racing. I'd love to stay in media. I love doing television. I love doing radio. I want to keep doing it, but at the same time, I understand that if we go down a different road and I'm not someone's cup of tea, and, you know, that's... You've got to take that on. It's a ruthless industry that you and I are in. You've been a remarkable survivor for, I don't want to say how many years, but we all know it's 40 years surviving in it. That's a great credit to you, because there's very few jobs. It's interesting. It's dog eat dog, but I refuse to go down that road.
No,
I refuse to say, if I'm working in a team, then it's about the team, and let's make sure everyone is good, because that reflects positively on all of us. And if that means that some young kid comes up and ends up taking my job, well, so be it.
Yeah.
Because it's about the bigger picture, as opposed to, my own little patch, which I'm keen to keep.
We want you to keep it. Thanks for spending some time with us. That's a good title, Spending Time.
Oh, gee, I've heard of that somewhere. Sure, I interviewed you one day on that.
Good to have you back here. Why do you call him Two Dogs?
That's the question. Just Google it. Just simply. You know, your silly little son actually asked me that. I said, are you serious? He goes, no, really. Everyone asks me, why do you call him Two Dogs? Just Google it.
That's KB. Thanks, Richard.
Good on you, BM.
Take care.